The other day, I was in Westminster, and I walked past a monument that I perhaps walked past many times before, but I'd never properly noticed it before. And it was the Cenotaph, the war memorial dedicated to all those who gave their lives, so that we can enjoy the freedoms that we have today. And as I walked past the memorial, it did make me stop and consider all those people who've given up their own lives. And it's right that we have these monuments. It's right that we have that remembrance service on the 11th of November. Because what would happen if we didn't? Well, quite quickly, the past would start fading from memory, and there'd be a danger that we just start to forget the past. Well, these verses we've just read were written to a people, God's people, who were in danger of forgetting their past. The original audience of this book, of this passage, wasn't the people at the Exodus, but their children, their grandchildren, post-exile, in the desert, entering the promised land. A people who had already been rescued, been saved, been liberated, and yet the years had started to pass. Memory had started to fade. And this book, the Exodus, this passage, was written to remind them of important past events, written to remind them of who they are as a nation, and most importantly, written to remind them of their God, who he is, and what he's like. And the first reminder in this passage is point one, he is a God who remembers, a God who remembers. 2:23. During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Back at school, my maths class was once given a piece of homework where we had to, as a class, over the weekend, try and memorize pi for as many digits as we could. So people went away over the weekend, came up with different strategies to do this. Then we came back on Monday. Some managed about 30 decimal places, others managed 60, a couple managed 100, and one managed 250. I won't tell you how many I did. But then afterwards, we looked and we found that the world record belonged to someone called Mr. Suresh Sharma in India, who memorized pi to over 70,000 digits using photographic memory and his Sherlock Mind Palace technique. And then he spent 10 hours reciting all the digits of pi that he could, which is quite remarkable. But even the most photographic of memories eventually hits a limit. Eventually, there's a limit on our capacity to remember. But not so with God, because God remembers everything, remembers every conversation, every word that he has spoken to every person throughout all of time. God remembers. Even if it was 10, 50, 100, 500 years ago, God doesn't forget the promises he makes to his people. He remembers every single one of them, which is why, even though his people have been in the foreign land of Egypt for hundreds of years, he hasn't forgotten them, because he remembers them. He remembers what he promised them. What specifically is God remembering here? He's remembering his covenant, his promises to the patriarchs, promises to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, promises of a land, promises of descendants, promises of a relationship with him. And specifically, he's remembering his promise back to Abraham in Genesis 15, where God said to Abraham, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterwards they shall come out with great possessions." God remembers his promises, remembers that he promised they will become a great nation, that he promised that one day they'll be liberated from the foreign land they find themselves in, aka Egypt. And that word remembered isn't just a thought, an intellectual thing. It implies that God is about to act. God heard his people's groaning, remembered his covenant, and now he's going to act. And this pattern of God remembering his promises to his people is repeated time again throughout the Bible. Promises to Noah, promises to Moses, promises to David, all remembered by God, not forgotten and acted on. He is a God who remembers. And if we let this truth sink in, it can just start to change how we think about the promises God makes to us, because they're made by someone who always remembers and acts on his promises. There's two or three school friends who I keep in touch with in London, and one of them's called Tom. And if we ever want to go play tennis as a group of four or something, in the group chat, we always know that Tom will say, oh yeah, I'll be there at 2, but then in reality, it's more like 2:30, 2:45, or 3. And over time, we just stop trusting what he says. But when God speaks, it's never like that. He always remembers. He always delivers. His words, his promises are concrete, rock solid. They don't need to be taken with a pinch of salt. And what a comfort it is that all the promises God makes to us in this book will come to pass. But perhaps it's also a challenge. Is there a promise of God that you've started to doubt, that you're really not sure he could deliver on? If so, then we need to remember and recognize who it is that is making that promise. Because we know that God won't ever forget his promises to his people, because he is a God who remembers. Point one, a God who remembers. But point two, he also is a God who reveals. A God who reveals. I've got a cousin who's a little bit younger, maybe 4 or 5, and one of his favorite board games to play is Who's Who. So you each sit there, and you have 30 cards of different people on one side, 30 cards of people on the other side. And you take it in turns to ask a series of questions to figure out the identity of the card that the other person has selected. So you ask, do they have glasses? Do they have a ponytail? Are they a man, etc.? And gradually you whittle down the options until you can guess who it is, this individual they've selected. And you know, I think we live in a world where many people like to guess what God is like. I like to think of God as this, or I think God might be like this, or in my experience, God is a little bit like that. But in Exodus 3, the guessing game stops, because God shows us what he's like. He arrives, he appears, he speaks, he reveals, he acts. We don't need speculation. We've got revelation. How does he reveal himself? Well, God appears to Moses in the burning bush, in a fire, a blazing fire that maintains itself somehow, perhaps revealing the raw glory and holiness and self-existent eternal nature of God. God tells Moses to be careful, revealing that he is holy, set apart, so holy that an unclean person shouldn't get near. God reveals his compassion. He tells Moses how he hears the groans of his people. He sees their pain. He knows what they're going through. And God reveals his sovereignty and power as he unpacks what he'll do, what will happen in the future. And God even introduces himself to Moses by name, Yahweh, I am who I am. And when God says, I am who I am, he's not just giving a name, he's giving him his nature. Unchanging, eternal, utterly self-existent. Not shaped by time or culture or need. He simply is. And no one else can say that. And yet this I am is also the one who sees, hears, and comes down to deliver his people. The eternal God isn't just remote, he's radically personal. And so all through this passage, God is revealing himself to Moses, and by extension his people, and the watching world, because he is a God who reveals. Recently, I've been doing a lot of job interviews, and with these job interviews I've been doing, basically the questions come down into two different types. So one category is coding, technical, mathsy. It's not quite memorizing Pi, but similar. And the other half is behavioral, where they're trying to figure out what you're like, how you think, how you operate, what sort of person you are, if you'd be a good fit for the team, cultural fit, and all of that. And these behavioral questions all begin with the same few words. They all begin with the words, tell me a time. So tell me a time when you influenced a decision. Tell me a time when you worked in a team. Tell me a time when you had to persevere, et cetera, et cetera. And the underlying principle to these behavioral questions is, the best way to tell what someone is like and how they will behave now is by looking back at their past behavior. Because that's how you can learn who someone is, how they operate, what they're really like. And I think it's similar with God. We can get to know him, what he's like now, by hearing about what he's done, how he's acted in the past, how he's acted in history. Because God is unchanging. He is who he is. So who he reveals himself to be in the Exodus is who he is now in London in 2025. And that's also who he will be forever, because he is unchanging. He is who he is. And once we know who he is, well, then we're able to relate to him as we ought. We're able to recognize him as this Lord, as holy, as sovereign, as powerful, as the one who has compassion on us, as the one who deserves our service, our sacrifice, our worship in all areas of life. So get to know him. Look at history, look at his word, to hear how he has acted in order to get to know him, the God who reveals. A God who remembers, a God who reveals, but point three, a God who rescues. Looking down at verse 7. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Another friend of mine from uni, not school this time, called George, organizes a music festival each year, and they get a good couple hundred down, maybe 1,000. And he does this partly because he enjoys music, but also because he wants to raise money for a cause. And that cause is the main charity they partner with, is the RNLI, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution. So each year, halfway through their festival, a representative from the RNLI comes and explains what they do. And their goal is simple, to save lives at sea. And so the representative will come and he'll explain what a day in the life looks like as someone who's there on the lifeboat, the danger signs they look for, how they carry out the rescues, what tools they have to get someone out of the water, what the process is. And he explained how everything they do is centered around that one goal, to save lives. Every decision, every action is to that end, to save lives, to deliver them from danger, bring them back to land. And I think that is a picture of what God is like in this passage. He is a God who saves lives. He's a God who rescues. Rescuing is fundamental to who God is. He's active. He sees his people's affliction, hears their cry, knows their suffering, and he steps in. He comes down to deliver, to bring his people up. And again, we see this throughout the Bible, with Noah, with Joseph, with Moses, with David. God is a God who rescues. And then we see a greater rescue, not just from Egypt, but from sin and death, not just with signs and wonders, but with a cross. In Jesus, God came down. I am who I am, walked among us, And he came down not just to hear our groans, but to carry them, to suffer in our place, and to rise again, to bring us home. This isn't just the God of Moses. This is the God we follow, a God who remembers, reveals, rescues today. Recently, I asked my uni friend, George, like, why does he do it? Why run this festival in support of RNLI? Why support them specifically? And actually, he told me that when he was about 14 or 15, he was involved in a serious motorboat incident, him and a few friends were out at sea. And it was the RNLI that saved their lives in a rescue effort, that pulled them out from the sea, delivered them from danger. And he said he'll forever be grateful for their service. And so as someone who was rescued, he wanted to do all he could to support the ongoing rescue effort. And it just made me think, if I'm a Christian, if we're Christians, we're a rescue people with a God who's all about rescue, living amidst a sea of people that need rescue. And it just made me think, what am I doing to support the rescue effort? What would it look like if I really believed in God's rescue mission? What would it look like if we, as a church, really believed God was a God who rescued? How might that, I was thinking, how might that change what I discuss at lunch with my colleagues? Or when I think about what it means to be godly, to reflect God, to be more like Jesus? Well, surely I need to take that idea of God being a rescuer more seriously, because the God we follow is a God who rescues. A God who remembers, a God who reveals, a God who rescues. So let's not forget what God is like. Let's remember the God who has remembered us. Let's respond to the God who has revealed himself. Let's follow the God who has rescued us. Because this is who our God is.